From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
In Scientology, it was discovered that as many as one in four people spend their whole lives keeping those around them feeling worried and overwhelmed.
In this economy, if you plan on keeping your jobs, you better be willing to do whatever it takes. All right, that's it.
Call it Tom Cruise on Tom Cruise Scientologist.
I think it's a privilege to call yourself a Scientologist, and it's something that you have to earn. Because a Scientologist does. He or she has the ability to create new and better realities and improve conditions.
Now, the real work here is to put man in a mental condition where he can solve his own problems. And the aim and goal of Scientology is to take an individual or a group, and by taking individuals in the group, put them in a position where they can confront their own problems and solve their own problems, and so bring themselves up by their own bootstraps.
That's L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of the Church of Scientology, one of the most controversial and secretive religions in the world. Mark Headley describes a bizarre encounter with one of the world's most famous Scientologists, Tom Cruise. And we'll hear the story of his dramatic escape from the church. We'll also look at the history of Scientology and Paul Thomas Anderson's film The Master. That movie generated a lot of buzz when it was released in 2012 and raised questions about how closely it was based on the church. But first...
Hello. My name is Elder Young.
Hello.
Did you know that Jesus lived here in the USA? You can read all about it now.
Hello.
In this nifty book, it's free, no, you don't have to pay.
Hello.
Hello. And you'll know it's all true, you'll just feel it. I believe.
Those are excerpts from a couple of songs from the smash Broadway musical The Book of Mormon. Mormonism is an American religion, but how much do we really know about it? Matthew Bowman is a Mormon who teaches American religious history at Hampton-Sydney College, and he's the author of The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith. Bowman tells us what he and the other members of his faith believe.
Most centrally, I think Mormons believe that while Jesus Christ was on the earth in the New Testament period, he gave his apostles priesthood authority to perform ordinances like baptism or the Lord's Supper, things like that. It was this priesthood authority, Mormons teach, which was lost at some point after the death of those first 12 apostles and which needed to be restored. Along with this, many Mormons will say there were certain doctrines that were important for properly understanding Christianity that were lost as well.
What kind of thing?
Things about the nature of God, for instance. Mormons believe that God is a man. God has a body, a physical body like that that Jesus Christ has, and that human beings are of the same kind, the same species that God himself is, that our spirits, our souls, are literally the children of God, and it's God's work, God's task, to help human beings progress to attain the same sort of divine relationship that God has with the other members of the Trinity.
So in a sense, you are searching for God within yourself?
Yeah, that we all have kind of a seed of divinity within us, and it's our task here on earth to discover that, to cultivate those virtues that will allow us to better understand who God the Father is.
Now, how is that different from regular Christians? Don't they also believe that God is within?
You know, the real difference is whether or not God, the Father is of a similar type that the creation is, that the world, the universe is. And the creeds of Christianity proclaim that God is separate. God is outside of this creation. This creation is fallen, this creation is ruined, and God has to save it. The scandal of Mormonism is that Mormons close that gap, and they say, no, God is like us. God is more like us than he is different. And that, for many Christians, really strikes at the foundations of what Christianity is all about, which is that God, being God, is the only one with the capacity to save us. We cannot save ourselves.
It sounds a little like hubris, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
Yeah. Joseph Smith is a kind of a mystery figure to a lot of Americans, I think. His name is known as the founder of the Latter-day Saint movement, but not a whole lot more about that. Maybe we know that he had visions, and for a lot of people that, forgive me, makes him sound a little wacko.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And I think that, you know, there's so much other stuff, I think, that's scandalous about Joseph Smith. He was a visionary. He claimed to see God. Of course, polygamy eventually becomes a scandal as well. He is a person like this. He is a larger-than-life figure, someone who really claims far and away more than what anybody around him was claiming. I think it's probably appropriate, historically, to put him in a camp with people like Joan of Arc or like Muhammad, these great kind of visionary figures who were scandalous in their times and remain so today.
Can you tell me quickly the story of the visions, his meeting with the angel and his discovery of the golden plates?
Yes. Mormons generally begin this in his teenage years. We're not sure exactly the year, but it was most likely in 1820 when he was 14, 15 years old. Joseph Smith was confused about what religion he should join. His mother had recently joined the Presbyterians, but his father was standing further back from that, and Joseph Smith prayed about this. He went into the grove of trees behind his house and later said that he saw God, that God and Jesus Christ perhaps appeared to him and told him that the true gospel of Jesus Christ was no longer on the earth. A few years later, he encountered an angel. The angel told Joseph Smith that he would bring forth a new work of scripture that would restore the original gospel of Jesus Christ to the earth, and he led Joseph Smith to these golden plates, which were buried in the earth in a hill near Joseph's house.
Part of what makes the story good at that point, I think, is that he wasn't allowed to take them right then.
Yes, initially, right.
He had to visit them four times over 4 years?
Three times, yeah, and he was allowed to take them on the last time. This is the way these sorts of stories always go, right, that the hero must return several times. The last time he was allowed to take the plates, and using the inspiration of God, he translated these plates, produced the Book of Mormon, which is this massive, dense, convoluted work of scripture that's deeply Christian at its core, and begins then to work what he called the restoration of the true gospel of Jesus Christ.
How important is the story within the Mormon religion? I'm curious, what do Mormons think of this story about being visited by an angel and translating these golden plates with God's help and creating the Book of Mormon? I mean, is there a kind of fundamentalism to it?
Yeah, you know, it's taken quite seriously, and it's taught to every young Mormon in their youth. They learn the story of Joseph Smith the same time they learn the story of Jesus Christ's nativity birth, or the travels of the Apostle Paul, or, you know, these kind of basic stories that are foundational to most Christians. Joseph Smith's story is right up there for Mormons with them, in part because Mormons are taught to see Joseph Smith as kind of a model for themselves. They'll hear, if you have religious questions, like Joseph Smith did, you should go and approach God with them. And God will tell you what you're supposed to do with your life. God will answer your questions. Joseph Smith has proven that the heavens remain open.
Is there room within Mormonism for another prophet with a perhaps competing vision?
Mormonism continues to have prophets. Every leader of the church, even up to the present day, is sustained by the membership of the church as a prophet, seer, and revelator, someone capable of doing what Joseph Smith did. But it's also worth noting that no leader of the church since Joseph Smith has come near to the sort of prophetic output that he himself produced. Brigham Young, who was Joseph Smith's immediate successor, even said, "I am not a prophet the way that Joseph Smith was a prophet," though Brigham Young did claim to receive divine direction.
You talk about Joseph Smith's revelations as being, well, peculiar to America, in a sense. You call them a form of social criticism calling for a profound reimagining of American society. I guess I'm curious, what was it he saw in American society that he thought needed to be reimagined?
Joseph Smith lived at a time of really wrenching changes in American life. This is the period of the Democratic Revolution, when Andrew Jackson had become president on this great populist platform saying common people can decide what they want to do. It was also the time of the market revolution, the first moment in which commercial capitalism had really begun to grasp hold of American life and really displaced earlier ways of life, the kind of independent farming that so many Americans had existed in before. Joseph Smith's own family were victims of the market revolution. His father had gone broke trying to make a living as a merchant, and it simply did not work for him. And we can really read, I think, Joseph's attempt to build this new kingdom, this Zion kingdom, as an attempt to turn back the clock on some of these things, as an attempt to create a really strongly bound, tightly knit, almost familial community that resisted the centrifugal pulls of the marketplace, and really is an attempt to reject capitalism. He institutes something that he calls the law of consecration, which requires all members of the church to turn over their property to the church and then receive back only what they need. Joseph said that in Zion there would be no rich and no poor. And this certainly, I think, is in some ways an attempt to deal with the new kind of poverty and financial boom and bust climate that the market revolution had created.
You know, one of the things that people are likely to most know about the Mormons or know about the Mormons is polygamy, plural marriage. That is no longer commonly practiced, although there are some who do.
Yes.
Where did that come from? What inspired Joseph Smith to incorporate this into Mormonism?
The LDS Church, the largest church, renounced polygamy in 1890, though there are many fundamentalist Mormon groups who do still practice it. Joseph Smith began polygamy in the mid-1840s, only a few years before he died. And he began it really because of how he was reimagining heaven. If we all have this divine potential within us, if we all will one day go to heaven and live with God, it's really important to him that we think of heaven in terms of families. We're the children of God, right? And so we want to live with our Father, but we also want to be with each other. And so he introduces this new sacrament called sealing, in which he says our relationships can be made permanent. The relationship between a husband and wife, between parents and children, can be sealed to eternity. So you will still be married to your spouse in eternity. And as he begins unpacking this doctrine, he starts to seal more and more people together. And he begins to teach that polygamy is a way to bind all of these people together. So he will marry the children of his closest associates. He'll marry their sisters. Their children will marry him. It's almost dynastic, really, in the same way that medieval European royalty used to intermarry, right? And what he really wanted to do was turn the Mormons into a community who are all bound together. Everybody would in some way be sealed to everybody else.
How much has Mormonism as a whole changed, evolved since the 20th century? Is it different in the 21st century than the religion that Joseph Smith received in his visions?
Certainly. I think the biggest way that Mormonism has changed is its growing comfort in the United States. There's a sociologist named Max Weber who argued that all religions begin with a charismatic founder who's very countercultural, who comes into a society and turns it upside down. But then after that founder dies, the religion institutionalizes and it settles down and it becomes much more ingratiated with the surrounding society. And I think this theory really fits Mormonism almost perfectly. Joseph Smith had this dramatically different vision of what society should be like. And Brigham Young certainly tried to carry that vision out. Brigham Young took the Mormons to Salt Lake City and tried to build an economic commune and tried to build a theocracy, and he ultimately failed. The 20th century is really the period in which Mormonism becomes much more comfortable in America, in which the Mormons adopt a lot of American values like capitalism, like democracy, things like this. And today, most Mormons have a hard time really seeing how their religion might be incompatible with the country they live in.
Matthew Bowman is the author of The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can let us know via Facebook or Twitter, or you can send us an email through our website, ttbook.org. It's always great to hear from you. Listening to music to the Hill Cumorah pageant by Crawford Gates, who conducted the Utah Symphony and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Coming up, we'll explore one of the world's most secretive religions, Scientology, as we continue our hour called What We Believe. Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard once allegedly said, "You don't get rich writing science fiction. If you want to get rich, you start a religion." Hubbard, famously, founded the Church of Scientology, one of the most controversial and secretive religions in the world. Hugh Urban is a professor of religious studies at Ohio State University. He's especially interested in how secrecy is used in religion. Urban's the author of The Church of Scientology, A History of a New Religion. He tells Steve Paulson why he calls L. Ron Hubbard a bricoleur.
That's a term that comes from the anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss, and he uses that to talk about the ways in which religious individuals pick and choose different pieces of many different things and put them together in interesting new ways. And I found that a really useful way to think about Hubbard, because he himself says that in the course of coming up with the idea of Dianetics and Scientology, that he explored everything. He explored automatic writing and clairvoyance and various chemicals, everything under the sun, in order to come up with his new science of how the mind works. And as he develops Dianetics, he's really incorporating many, many different things. There are elements of psychoanalysis, sort of popular therapy and self-help that was just getting going in the early 1950s. He eventually brings in elements of Eastern religions like Hinduism and Buddhism and puts it all together in this fairly remarkable new synthesis that became incredibly successful and popular in the early 1950s and then took off in the 1960s.
And before Hubbard created Scientology, he developed what he called a new science of the mind, which is what he called Dianetics. What was the basic premise here?
Well, the term Dianetics he used, taking it from the Greek dia and nous, meaning through the mind. And the idea of Dianetics is that all of our problems come through the mind, and therefore all the solutions come through the mind as well. Hubbard believed that he had understood how the mind really works, and he divided the mind into two basic parts: the reactive mind, which is very similar to the psychoanalytic idea of the unconscious, which is a repository of negative experiences that we have throughout our life. Moments of pain and unconsciousness become burned in the reactive mind in the form of what Hubbard called engrams, which are negative memory traces that then cause us problems in the future, both physical problems and psychological problems. The other part of the mind he called the analytical mind, which works like a flawless computer and sees the world accurately. And so the process of Dianetics involves going back and identifying where these negative memory traces lie, a process that he called auditing. And once you have identified and talked through these negative memory experiences, then they're cleared from your reactive mind. And eventually, once all of those experiences have been removed, you achieve the state called clear, which he described as an optimum state of psychological and physical well-being.
So when he started talking about Dianetics, did this movement gain much traction among people?
It did. It was a surprising success to everyone, including Hubbard himself. The book Dianetics, when it was published in 1950, went to the top of the New York Times bestseller list and remained there for 28 weeks. The movement really took off like wildfire across the U.S. It was really the first major popular form of self-help at the time. And there were small Dianetics clubs that popped up all over the country. The success of Dianetics did not last very long, only a year or so before the movement actually went bankrupt. And it was at that point that Dianetics in its early form sort of fizzled. And shortly after that, Scientology takes its place.
Why would Dianetics go bankrupt if it was so popular?
Well, part of it is that it was a decentralized movement. That is, anyone could read the book and start forming little Dianetics clubs around the country. So it was becoming very popular by word of mouth, but the revenue wasn't necessarily coming back to Hubbard himself. There are also disputes within the early Dianetics community between Dianetics and some of his early supporters who felt that he was increasingly authoritarian and that he was also pushing Dianetics in a direction that was increasingly unscientific. Initially, Dianetics was presented as a science of the mind, but very quickly he began exploring things that seemed to some supporters as non-scientific, such as past life experiences, reincarnation, and things like that.
So what is the difference then between Dianetics and Scientology? Because he basically moved from Dianetics to establish the Church of Scientology.
That's right. So Dianetics lasts for about a year or so, and then pretty much fizzles by 1952, 1953. And out of the sort of the ashes of early Dianetics emerges the Church of Scientology. One of the key differences is that Dianetics is focused primarily on this lifetime and examining, talking through, and clearing the engrams from this lifetime. Very quickly, people who are practicing Dianetics began to believe that they were recalling past life experiences as well. And that's when Hubbard developed the idea of what he calls the Thetan, which is our spiritual self, which is eternal and lasts beyond this particular body. And he began developing elaborate ideas of past life experiences, some going back billions and trillions of years. So Scientology introduced a spiritual dimension that was not there in Dianetics. Well, that's one reason for the emergence of Scientology. Another is that Dianetics practitioners began to be investigated by the FDA and by different medical boards. Several practitioners of Dianetics in the 1950s were arrested for practicing medicine without a license. And so part of the reason for the shift from Dianetics to Scientology was a shift in the spiritual direction, so that if they're practicing a spiritual therapy and not making claims to physical healing, they're no longer under the scrutiny of the FDA and medical boards.
Now, the other thing that you say about the founding of Scientology is this was very much a religion that came into being during the Cold War. It was to some degree a product of that era of anti-communism. Can you explain this?
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting parts of the development of Scientology to me. And so I really spent a good chunk of the book looking at that piece of the puzzle, Scientology's growth and development during the Cold War. And I made that argument for a couple of reasons. One, Hubbard himself presented Dianetics and Scientology really as the solution to nuclear war. Like others, he believed that the human race was probably going to destroy itself by nuclear war unless we learned how to control ourselves, as it were. So in promoting Dianetics and Scientology, he really presented it as the solution to the atomic bomb. Secondly, he was really concerned with communism throughout his writings. In the early 1950s, he wrote numerous letters to the FBI and to J. Edgar Hoover himself, identifying communist threats both externally and within his own organization. And third, I argued that the preoccupation that Scientology had with secrecy and security and information control is really a microcosm of the larger Cold War American concern with secrecy and information control. So not only did Scientology develop its own highly classified upper levels of training, like the OT3 levels, it also developed its own sort of intelligence office, the Guardian's office, which was concerned with sort of policing the flow of information within and without the Church of Scientology, and eventually became involved in really remarkable, elaborate espionage and counter-espionage with the IRS and other U.S. government offices.
We should talk about some of these more secretive practices. I mean, certainly one of the most controversial ones is called the OT3, the Operating Thetan 3, which I guess only advanced practitioners of Scientology get into. What is this?
So OT stands for Operating Thetan, and these are upper levels of Scientology auditing that go beyond the state of clear. So once you've achieved the state of clear, which you've cleared all your negative memory traces from this lifetime, then you enter these more advanced levels. The term or phrase Operating Thetan means a thetan or spiritual entity that's become more and more independent or free of the material world and eventually is claimed to have various supernatural abilities. So in the Scientology map, or what's called the Bridge to Total Freedom, there are listed 15 of these operating Thetan levels. Hubbard only appears to have completed 8 of them before his death. The most controversial one is this third one, Operating Thetan Level 3, which is the one that reveals the story about Emperor Xenu and the past history of planet Earth and extra body Thetans and all of that.
I guess I'm unclear. Why do you have to have this advanced level of practice before you would hear about this foundational story about the Emperor Xenu?
Well, according to Scientology literature and Hubbard's own statements, it would be dangerous for individuals who weren't prepared to have this information revealed to them. It could do psychological or even physical harm. He called Operating Thetan Level 3 the wall of fire that was very difficult for him to break through and understand. And so individuals who didn't have the correct training just wouldn't be able to handle it, in the same way that if you didn't have the correct training to go rock climbing on a steep cliff face, you would be in danger.
Do you need the correct psychological training, the correct spiritual training, I guess?
Correct.
Why all the secrecy, though? I mean, why not just put all this out in the open and let people practice as they want?
Well, that's a real interesting, difficult, and controversial question. Cynics, of course, would say that the secrecy is there to protect its value. The operating Thetan levels become quite expensive. To get to operating Thetan Level 8, it's been estimated that one would have to pay between $300,000 and $400,000.
$400,000? Who are you paying this to?
Well, they're listed as donations to the Church of Scientology, but they are set donations.
For what? I mean, what do you get for paying all that money?
The knowledge and training that one acquires through going through the auditing levels that accompany each of these operating Thetan levels. And along with that, the increased freedom and independence of the Thetan from the material world. And purportedly, one also has supernatural abilities. One of the things that Hubbard claimed was that a Thetan who becomes increasingly independent can exteriorize or leave the body, can become clairvoyant. If you read accounts of Scientologists in many of Scientology publications, such as Advance Magazine, they claim all sorts of supernatural abilities from having gone through the operating Thetan levels. Everything from being able to fix broken appliances to healing their pet cat to exteriorizing from the body and flying around the universe.
So you are a historian of religion. You know, you've looked at the histories of a lot of different religions. How do you look at this history and the stories that you hear about Scientology?
Many aspects of Scientology seem pretty out there to most Americans when they first encounter them. But if you think about it, many aspects of many religions seem pretty out there to those who don't grow up in those traditions. So if you told someone who'd never heard of Christianity the story of the Garden of Eden and that there was a talking snake and there was a tree with an apple and then they got kicked out of the garden, someone who had never encountered that story before would find that pretty strange. In the same way that someone who's never encountered Hindu mythology finds the stories about Shiva and Krishna and Kali and Durga quite bizarre, or someone who's never encountered Native American spirituality or African religions. So in that context, in the broader history of the kinds of narratives that human beings have come up with to explain the universe, the story about intergalactic Emperor Xenu really isn't that out there. I think it seems out there to most Americans because of the science fiction elements, knowing that Hubbard was a science fiction author, the fact that it's a new religion. When we think of ourselves as scientific and modern and rational, to have a story with this many unusual science fiction elements probably strikes most Americans as more bizarre than a Hindu myth written 2,000 years ago.
Well, there is also the question of whether Scientology actually is a religion, although you say in your book that you think that's the wrong question to ask, and the right question is who gets to define religion?
Yeah. So what I argued in the book is that our definition of religion is always changing. So, for example, in the mid-19th century, when Mormonism comes along, Mormonism was also considered crazy and occult. Joseph Smith and his followers were chased halfway across the country. These days, however, Mormonism is one of the largest denominations in the world. Some consider it an independent world religion in its own right, with millions and millions of followers. So how we understand religion is always changing. And the period after World War II was a period in which it was changing very quickly, as we have new imports coming from the East and all sorts of new religions emerging in the United States. So I thought it was more interesting to think about how religion gets defined and who gets to define it. And it's really not a question of a few academics like me writing away in universities defining religion. Rather, it involves a whole number of different agents, including not just scholars, but also the religious practitioners. It involves courts. It involves lawyers. It involves government agencies like the IRS and the FDA, the State Department, etc., the media, journalists, etc. So it's really a much more complex conversation and debate that is always evolving and changing over time. So to me, that's a more interesting way of thinking about it than simply saying it is or isn't a religion, because 20 years from now, we'll probably be thinking about religion differently than we are right now.
Hugh Urban is the author of The Church of Scientology, A History of a New Religion. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Since Scientology is so secretive, it's hard to get the inside story about what really goes on there. But Mark Headley knows firsthand. He spent 15 years working for the Church of Scientology, averaging, he says, over 100 hours a week, and being paid less than 50 cents an hour. Headley eventually became a key staff member of Scientology's international management headquarters in California, but he left the church in 2005. He chronicles his experiences in his book, Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology. Mark Headley tells Anne Strainchamps about his encounters with one of the world's most famous Scientologists.
Tom Cruise was, in Scientology, what they call an auditor, and I was his pre-clear, which is the person that's subject to the auditing.
What's an auditor?
An auditor is someone in Scientology who does processing, Scientology processing on somebody. They have what they call the bridge to total freedom, and it has a processing side and it has a training side. And an auditor is someone who practices the processing on another person and moves them through all these different processes that could take anywhere from a month to a year to get through a certain step of this processing. And when Tom Cruise started as an auditor, he had to audit somebody. That's the role that I played. I was the person that he was auditing on these very introductory and basic Scientology processing tasks that he did on me.
He was training on you.
That's correct. I was kind of like his guinea pig.
So what did he do? What did this involve?
Basically, very introductory, what they're called training routines and introductory auditing commands, where you're basically indoctrinating the person to be able to get audited and to do basic processing. And it's kind of a gradient approach to then you're going to then move on to doing more advanced processing on this person. But in order for them to be able to do that, they have to get through these rudimentary procedures and sort of get indoctrinated on how auditing and processing works in Scientology. So there's a lot of people that talk about, you know, in Scientology, some of these early things where you talk to an ashtray and you're walking over to them, touching walls and windows and stuff like that. And that's the sort of processing that he did on me.
Wait, you talk to an ashtray?
That's correct. You yell at an ashtray.
Why?
It's to show you that you can have control over an object and you can get the intention that you have in your mind. You can communicate it across a space into an object, and it's not that easy to explain.
Is the ashtray supposed to do something?
Well, you physically move the ashtray as you're yelling at it. So you tell the ashtray to stand up. You don't just use like a little small ashtray. You use a really big, like 8-inch by 8-inch thick glass ashtray, and you tell it to stand up, and then you lift it out of a chair, and then you tell it to sit down, and then you put it back in the chair. And this can go on for hours upon hours, day after day, until you can confidently and successfully do this.
Are you telling me that Tom Cruise sat with you for like hours and hours telling you to yell at an ashtray and then move it around the room and then tell it thank you?
That is exactly correct. We also played with books and bottles and He asked me all sorts of questions, and we did a lot of this on the E-meter, which is a sort of a device, an electric device they use in Scientology and in Scientology auditing and counseling.
So when you were still in the Scientology community and, you know, working at a fairly high level, did you believe all the Scientology teachings, or were you just going through the motions? I mean, for example, did you believe the idea that a human is an immortal alien?
Well, I grew up in it, so I didn't know anything else. I didn't know any better. I didn't know anything differently. And when you're in Scientology, you're pretty much indoctrinated that Scientologists are a smarter, more advanced breed of person, that you're better than everyone else, so that if anybody else said this is the way it was and it was contrary to Scientology, then you would just look down on it and be like, oh, they're crazy.
Now, you also had a fair amount of contact with the Church of Scientology's leader, David Miscavige. What did you think of him?
I really never had anyone to compare him to until I left. And I saw a documentary on Jonestown. And that's the only person that I've ever seen or heard about that I think would most closely match him in terms of being very charismatic and being someone who can convince people to do things and who rub shoulders with the politicians and the celebrities and then, you know, pass out the Kool-Aid. That's the only person I could really compare him to, just because he is a tyrant. I've seen him physically assault Scientology's highest executives.
Assault how?
They've denied it and they've, you know, said, oh, these are all lies. And then eventually more and more people who had also witnessed these abuses started coming out and then telling their stories. And they were all exactly the same. Yes, David Miscavige, he slaps people, punches people, hits them, throws them to the ground, all these insane things. At a certain point, when I kind of decided that I really needed to expose what I knew and basically tell as much as I could, was after I'd seen this documentary on Jonestown, because I truly believe if they passed out the Kool-Aid tomorrow, that the people that I worked with would drink it in a second. And I just thought, this is crazy. You know, how is this possible that this could be happening in a modern day group and society?
There's one really weird episode you describe involving some kind of perversion of the musical chairs game that David Miscavige used?
That's correct. We were basically assembled by David Miscavige, and we were told that we were going to play a game of musical chairs. And essentially, whoever lost a chair was going to be shipped off to far corners of the world to do menial and demeaning jobs in Scientology organizations, like cigarette butt cleaner upper and toilet scrubbing in charge and sort of things like this. And as people lost chairs and were separated from their wives or their husbands, and it was a very dramatic, insane episode that occurred, and it went on for hours, and eventually one woman was the one left, and David Miscavige said, okay, good, you can stay here and work with me, and everybody else is out of here. And he went so as far to have plane tickets printed up for people so that they knew he wasn't joking. They were absolutely being shipped off to wherever it was to do these very, very demeaning punishments for could be years on end. And then the next morning, it was like it never happened. And he was like, oh, no, it's going to cost too much money to ship you guys all over the place. So no one's going anywhere.
Did you actually witness that?
I was there. I was one of the people. I fought with a gentleman named Marty Rathbun over a chair. And I think I ended up throwing him to the ground to get the chair over him sitting in it.
Mark, by far the most dramatic story you tell in the book is the story of your own departure from the Church of Scientology. You literally had to escape. And people came after you. Can you tell the story?
Yeah, well, in addition to them just not letting you leave in the first place, between the barbed wire fences and the armed guards, etc., if you do, in fact, manage to escape, in my case, they chased me down in a security SUV. I was fleeing the property on a motorcycle, and I was driving down the road, And after them repeatedly nudging me or yelling out the window for me to pull over or to return to the property, they essentially just ran me off the road, just slowly nudged me over as we were driving, and there was no more shoulder left, and I crashed the motorcycle. The security officer that was driving the vehicle got out of the vehicle, grabbed the key out of my bike, and basically insisted that I return to the property, get in the SUV, and they were taking me back. At that point, I waved down passing motorists, and the security guard threw the key to my motorcycle back to me. I sort of gathered myself and got the bike. The bike was slightly damaged. And within minutes of me getting kind of back on the road, they continued to follow me. And then they just turned around and drove back. And 10 seconds, 30 seconds later, Riverside County Sheriff's Department vehicle pulled me over, and they had a 911 call that there was some gentlemen fighting on the highway, and basically the police escorted me to safety into the nearby town. And that is the only reason that I was able to escape. If those police would not have shown up when they did, I would be there to this day. I almost am certain of it.
Mark Headley is the author of Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs. What do you think of Scientology? You can share your opinions by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find links to our Facebook page and Twitter account there. Coming up, we'll try to figure out how much of the film The Master is based on the Church of Scientology as we conclude our hour called What We Believe. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Tony Ortega is the former editor-in-chief of The Village Voice. He left the paper in 2012 to write a book about Scientology. During his time at The Voice, Ortega wrote hundreds of blog posts about Scientology, so he seemed like the perfect choice to talk about the film The Master, and whether or not it's a movie about Scientology.
It portrays a mid-century man who is leading sort of a spiritual movement, and he brings on a troubled veteran, World War II veteran, who is a drunk running from his past. And the master, the man leading the movement, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, does his best to try to reform this troubled man, played by Joaquin Phoenix. So it's really a character study of these two men as their relationship develops. It's really fascinating.
It takes place, what, in the 50s, early 60s?
They repeatedly say 1950, so I think it's supposed to take place over several months in the year 1950.
Now, you have been following Scientology for a number of years, writing about it for The Village Voice. How much do you think that the writer and the director of The Master, Paul Thomas Anderson, was influenced by Scientology, by L. Ron Hubbard?
Well, there's just no question that he researched Scientology to an incredible degree, and then sat down and wrote a script which is just thoroughly infused with Scientology. We interviewed him a few weeks ago. It was obvious from the script how much he had done research, but then to our interviewer, he talked about how he had gotten down to 1950s newsletters put out by Scientologists. The research he did was so painstaking. I was really surprised, but if you read the script, you can see it in there. There's so much in there that's about Scientology, but also specific Scientology history. Now, not everything in that script made it into the movie on the screen, but there's still Scientology nearly from beginning to end in this film.
So give me an example. Are there noted parallels between the two?
Well, there's parallels on several different levels. On the one level, it's kind of a biographical movie about L. Ron Hubbard. And the analog of him in the movie is a man named Lancaster Dodd, who's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. Hubbard was married. His third wife was named Mary Sue, and she was a very steely companion who helped him run the organization. That's exactly the way Amy Adams plays Peggy Dodd in the film. Hubbard's oldest son, L. Ron Hubbard Jr., was in the movement, then he was out of the movement. He kind of betrayed his dad at times. That's exactly how Dodd's oldest son, Val, is played by Jesse Plemons. So there's that parallel on one level where it's just sort of a biographical sketch. But then the activities in the film, the way that Dodd's movement called The Cause is actually expressed, is very similar to the way Scientology works, the way that you're supposed to go back into your past lives even, to find traumatic incidents and then handle those memories so that your life today can be better. It's just uncanny the way these processes are reflected on the screen.
I still find it difficult to see the proof with regards to past lives that your movement claims.
Would you care to submit yourself to processing? Look through the telescope, as my friend said.
Well, perhaps another time. You've also said that these methods, cause methods, can cure leukemia, according to your book. And
some forms of leukemia. In being able to access past lives, we are able to treat illnesses that may have started back thousands, even trillions of years.
Trillions?
With a T, sir.
The Earth is not understood to be more than a few billion years old.
Well, even the smartest of our current scientists can be fooled. Yes.
You can understand skepticism.
Yes.
Can you not?
Yes, yes. For without it, we'd be positives and no negatives. Therefore, zero charge. We must have it.
Good science, by definition, allows for more than one opinion, doesn't
it? Which is why our gathering of data is so far-reaching.
Otherwise, you merely have the will of one man, which is the basis of cult. Is it not?
Tis. Tis. And thankfully, we are, all of us, working at breakneck speeds and in unison towards capturing the mind's fatal flaws and correcting it back to its inherent state of perfect. Whilst righting civilization and eliminating war and poverty, and therefore the atomic threat.
Now, again, you've studied Scientology. You know quite a lot about it. You've written a lot about it. Are there ways that the Master is different from Scientology?
It's different for the most part in really cosmetic ways. Anderson has just taken the names and changed them. He's changed the dates. He's telescoped events. He's created composite characters. But the correlations are just so similar. So while you're going through auditing in Scientology, you're going through processing in The Cause. While you're asked to not blink during auditing, and if you do, they yell, "Flunk." In the film, if you blink during processing, they yell infringement. I mean, it's that one-to-one. It's really remarkable. So I know that there was some noise made by some of the filmmakers that, oh, this could be about any New Age movement of the mid-century. But I got to tell you, those of us who really know Scientology don't buy that for a minute. Anderson very consciously set out to write a film about Hubbard and the early movement.
He has said that it's about Scientology.
Absolutely. Yeah, he told our interviewer that. He told a panel that in Venice. He has been more open about that. The actors are still saying it's not about Scientology. And I think that they're doing that merely because they don't want to get the kind of harassment that was experienced by, say, Matt Stone and Trey Parker of South Park because of what they ran into 6 or 7 years ago.
Scientology does have a history of coming after people who they think abuse their rights.
Yeah. In 2005, Parker and Stone created a really amazing episode of South Park. The first half of that episode is very loosely playing around with Scientology, but then it gets serious and it really does show the most secret upper level teachings of Scientology that they try to keep under wraps about these space aliens coming to Earth 75 million years ago.
Back then, there was a galactic federation of planets, which was ruled over by the evil Lord Xenu. Xenu thought his galaxy was overpopulated, and so he rounded up countless aliens from all different planets, and then had those aliens frozen.
And there didn't seem to be much of a result of that. But then just last year, some documents surfaced showing that Scientology did at least plan a concerted effort to investigate Parker and Stone, investigate their friends, go through their trash, try to get a mole into their office. These were documents that were leaked by high-level Scientology officials who had left at that point. So I think, you know, when you see Philip Seymour Hoffman and Amy Adams going around saying this isn't about Scientology, I think they just don't want to incur the wrath of an organization with such a reputation for retaliation.
Of course, the film is getting a lot of great reviews. It's being taken very seriously. And Philip Seymour Hoffman and Amy Adams and Joaquin Phoenix, for that matter, are all being touted as examples of the great skill that our current acting community doesn't always show. What do you think of the film itself? Is it a good film? Is it a great film?
The critics love it. It was a little bit hard for me to evaluate as simply as a movie-going experience because I was so madly taking notes in the dark about all the Scientology in the film. You know, I'm a big fan of Stanley Kubrick, and the Kubrickian moments in this film really hit me over the head. I thought they were great. I'm hearing other people saying that it's an arty film, it's too slow and too long, and Joaquin Phoenix is a little over the top. I think it's going to be one of those great movies where people have a lot of different opinions about it, and a lot of people are going to go see it, and it's going to have a big influence, like Anderson's other films. If you're a fan of Anderson, you will recognize a lot of the same tropes in this film as you've seen in There Will Be Blood and Magnolia, that kind of thing.
Well, I guess that answers my next question in a way, but I'll ask it anyway. Why does it matter if the Master is or isn't based on Scientology?
I think purely from a filmmaking point of view, it doesn't really matter. You know, Paul Thomas Anderson has created another movie that will be talked about, and he just happened to choose Scientology as its background. But I think in other ways it is very important because Hollywood has had an interesting relationship with Scientology for many years. And while we're familiar with a lot of their celebrities, there are other people that are not happy with Scientology's presence in Hollywood. And there have been attempts before this to portray Scientology in film and television, and producers have had a very hard time getting that done. So I think this film is significant because it really is marking a shift in Hollywood where it is becoming increasingly more common for Scientology to be the subject of art and criticism.
And this is where we are at. At the lowest level. To have to explain ourselves. For what? For what we do, we have to grovel. The only way to defend ourselves is to attack. If we don't do that, we will lose every battle that we are engaged in. We will never dominate our environment the way we should unless we attack.
Tony Ortega is the former editor-in-chief of The Village Voice. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program What We Believe. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Sarah Nix. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.